Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Telling the time in hours and minutes seems so natural, we don't even question where it came from. However, it's actually a very recent development. For most of history, our ancestors didn't have clocks and understood time itself in a very different way. In this podcast, we're going to journey back through the centuries to explore how our ancestors told the time. It's a really interesting history. Like in the medieval world, the length of an hour changed every day. We're going to look at how that worked and how Dublin in the 1870s had two separate time zones. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer. Today's episode begins by returning to medieval Dublin 800 years ago, where we'll take a look at the medieval city as it was and the way people lived their lives to get an insight into how time was understood by our distant ancestors. Then in the second part of the show, we'll travel to Victorian Dublin after clocks had been invented, but the city grappled with one major problem. Every clock seemed to tell a different time. Now, while all this will make for a fascinating podcast, this week also sees the launch of part 3 of my exclusive supporter series on the Troubles with Dr. Brian Hanley. Episode 3 in the series looks at the Battle of the Bogside in Derry and then the IRA split of 1969 that would shape how the conflict developed. If you're a patron of the show, you can access that episode on Thursday at patreon.com/Irish podcast. If you're not a supporter yet, but you would like to hear the series, you can support the show at patreon.com/Irish podcast and get hours of bonus content, including my latest series on the outbreak of the Troubles. Finally, I've posted lots of content relating to this episode on my new WhatsApp and Telegram channels. I also have lots of short videos posted there, including one this week about an Irish survivor of the Great Hunger who went down with the Titanic. Sound on today's show is by Kate Dunleavy. To begin, we need to turn the clock back 8 centuries. So try and ignore the sounds of the modern world and imagine yourself in Dublin in the year 1224, exactly 800 years ago. Dublin, at the time, is a small, muddy, dirty town by modern standards, but everything around you is alien compared to your experience of the world. The smells are overpowering. From one lane to the next, the waft of freshly baked bread gives way to stomach-churning odours from cesspits. The streets are narrow and shaded. Direct sunlight has difficulty penetrating through the canopy of roofs that lean out over the street. It's also extremely noisy. Animals compete with the sounds from workshops, the distant chants of monks in prayer, and in 1224, the din of construction at Dublin Castle as the huge military fortification in the southeast corner of the city nears completion. Each and every step in this city provokes questions and curiosity. However, the most bewildering thing you're going to encounter in the Dublin of 1224 is time. There are no clocks or watches, and people measure time in the most confusing fashion. Perhaps the best way to understand this is to ask someone for the time, but when they answer, it's not the answer you expect or want. After you query the time, they might point you in the direction of a sundial, but more likely they'll glance upwards at the sky, taking in the position of the sun, and then they might calibrate this by looking at the length of shadows cast by familiar landmarks around them, and finally give you an answer that's going to leave you none the wiser. For argument's sake, let's say it's mid-morning, so they might respond and tell you it's the third hour. Now your instinct, coming from the 21st century, might be to assume that this somehow relates to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It doesn't. As I said, they understand time in the medieval world in a completely different fashion. It's almost elastic in their conception of it. Now, if you took the risks involved and hung around the medieval city until after dark, you'll start to get an insight into how medieval time works. At dusk, Dublin, like all medieval cities, comes to a standstill. With no artificial lighting, it's almost impossible to do anything after dark. Many towns even institute curfews, demanding merchants cease their business and people return to their homes. It's only in the early hours of the morning, as the sun rises, that the city regains its lost vitality and people return to the streets. Now, this experience of nighttime highlights the two most important times in the medieval day, sunrise and sunset, light and dark, and these are the twin foundations on which the medieval conception of time is built. So rather than having a clock of 24 60-minute hours, they, for reasons you can probably now start to appreciate, divide their day into night and day. They then divide each of these periods, night and day, into 12 hours each. However, this now means that the length of an hour is constantly changing with the length of the day as it changes throughout the year. So when that person in 1224 tells you it's the third hour, what they actually mean is that it's the third of 12 hours of daylight. They've calculated this by observing the sun is a quarter of the way across the sky. Now, this system seems totally chaotic today. The length of an hour was constantly changing. It wasn't 60 minutes. However, this system had been developed in the Mediterranean world, where the number of hours in the day and at night didn't vary much. However, in Northern Europe, in Britain and Ireland, it was tested to its extremes, where summer days are very long and winter days are very short. This meant, in summer, an hour could be anything up to 90 minutes, but in winter it could just be 30 minutes long. So it's little surprise that this system began to change first in Northern Europe, when new ways of regulating time began to emerge in the 14th century, and it was here that our system of time began. Time, as I said at the beginning of the show, is essentially a human invention, and it is shaped by human behaviours. The relatively simple understanding of time that existed in Dublin in 1224, of dividing darkness and light into 12 equal hours that continually changed, reflected a society that was far less complex than our own. The population of Dublin, for example, at the time was small by modern standards, probably somewhere between 5 and 10,000 people. Nevertheless, life in the city was becoming increasingly complex through the 13th century. Dublin was interlinked not only with its own hinterland, but other towns across Ireland and Britain. People increasingly needed a specific time measurement to structure their days. To this end, clocks began to appear across Europe from around 1280 onwards. The earliest one seems to have been developed in England, and this is most likely because in Northern Europe, the system of dividing daylight into 12 equal hours didn't work as well as it did in the Mediterranean. The first clock, in principle at least, did exactly what your watch does. It broke time into hours of equal length, day or night, winter or summer. This allowed for far more specific organisation when it came to planning daily life. Now, the technology behind the mechanical clock, using gears, weights and wheels, was probably not an invention, however. The historian Marissa Adamini has pointed out that it just utilised technology already in use in flour mills. It was the growing complexity of life that led to the adoption of these mechanical clocks. However, all things considered, these mechanical clocks were still very crude devices compared to what you have on your wrist right now. They didn't have minute dials, they just told the time in hours. They were constantly losing times and were set by a sundial, which could provide an accurate reading at midday. When the first of these clocks was erected in Ireland is unknown. That device is now lost to time. However, the man who made the clock, or perhaps repaired it, has left the faintest trace in the historical record. In 1336, a man, Walter Legret, described as a clockmaker, is recorded in a property transaction buying land on Patrick Street in Dublin. What this Walter's clock would have looked like is something that historians also disagree over. Some argue that these early clocks had no hands at all and that the mechanism only rang a bell on the hour to note the time. Now, this would have had advantages in the medieval world. A sound carries over much longer distances than people could see a clock, for example. Whatever the nature of these clocks, however, over the following decades, some people at least slowly began to organise their days around the time on these devices. In 1387, a document in Dublin referenced an event taking place at 9 o'clock on August 30th. This description of 9 o'clock was a new innovation. The term o'clock or of the clock only came into existence with mechanical clocks. However, at this point, it is worth bearing in mind that these clocks were used or had value only for a tiny minority of the population. If you lived on and worked the land, you had no real need for a clock or clock time. The rising and setting of the sun were the two most important times in your day. An account from as late as the 1890s gives you a good sense of how people in rural Ireland viewed time. Although this is from the late 19th century, it is similar to the way people would have understood time in 1400 or probably even the year 400. The account was written by John Millington Synge when he visited the Aran Islands off the west coast of Galway. Given he was one of the few people on the island with a watch, the islanders did regularly ask him the time. However, when he replied with a specific hour, this information was of no use to the islanders, and they responded by asking him the more pertinent question for them: how long was it before the sun would go down? Nevertheless, while this method of measuring time remained common in rural societies until the 20th century, the situation in towns and cities was very different. Through the 16th century, clock time continued to infiltrate the worlds of business and government. Irish records from the year 1600 frequently refer to a specific time of the day for official meetings. In the 17th and 18th centuries, clock time continued its slow march onwards, although the devices in use in Ireland were still surprisingly vague. Even as late as 1842, when the German Johann Kohl visited Ireland, he noted how public clocks did not have a minute hand. Interestingly, however, he was impressed by the fact that this solitary hand on the clock was painted with a luminous material that made it visible at night. Now, basic as clocks were in the 1840s, Ireland was actually on the threshold of huge change by the mid-19th century. As society would develop a need and obsession for extreme accuracy when it came to time. The best place we can understand this is by returning to Dublin, this time in the 1870s, 750 years nearly after our last visit. Dublin of the 1870s was a very different place to the medieval city. While it might have been small by European standards, it was still home to nearly 250,000 people. Now, strolling around Victorian Dublin, something you would immediately notice is the number of clocks. Buildings across the city are emblazoned with clocks, and these have become extremely sophisticated devices. They have two hands and can tell the time down to the specific minute. Watches, although they have been around for centuries, are also becoming more affordable, so many middle-class people in the city also have their own timepiece. However, if you were to spend much time walking around Victorian Dublin, you will notice something that's a major problem with these clocks. They all tell a different time. For example, on one day in 1873, when time was measured in the city, the Alliance Gas Company clock on Sir John Rogerson's quay was 10 minutes behind the clock on the Customs House, just a little bit up the Liffey. If you wandered into Westland Row Station on that day, you would find two clocks there. They also showed two different times, 3 minutes and 15 seconds apart. Even the city clockmakers weren't able to provide more accurate time. Each one had their own specific measurement of what time of the day it was. Now, in previous centuries, no one would have even noticed such minor discrepancies. But in Victorian Dublin, life was becoming far, far too complex for such discrepancies to continue.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Clocks and the regulation of time, as we understand it, had been developed during the Industrial Revolution as hundreds and sometimes thousands of people worked in the one factory, sometimes around the clock. This demanded absolute precision. Now, in Dublin, the situation and the driver behind this requirement for precision in terms of time was driven by something slightly different. You see, Dublin had never really experienced an industrial revolution in the way Belfast or Manchester had, but in the 1870s, it was undergoing another revolution. This was a transport revolution. Through the previous 7 decades, a network of roads, canals, and then trains had radiated out from the city and across the island. Each day, thousands of trains, barges, boats, and carriages brought people and goods into the city. Many, if most, then had to be funneled through the city streets to the port and from there exported around the world. By 1864, Irish railway passengers were taking 12 million journeys each year. Now, this was small compared to Britain, but it was still a very complex operation. It required a small army of workers to keep this system running. By 1871, in Dublin alone, there were 1,000 people who worked on the railways. From engine drivers, stokers, station masters and train attendants, they all played a key role in keeping the system moving. Meanwhile, there were also 2,000 dock workers that managed the export of those goods and people as they arrived in the city. Now, all these people needed to start and finish work at specific times so another shift could take over, and this required accurate understandings of time. But this was only one aspect of life in Dublin that required careful planning, coordination and organisation. Trains had to be scheduled to the exact minute. In the port, ships had to depart the city on time. Never before had accurate time been so important, and by 1871, there were 231 clock and watchmakers in the city churning out watches and clocks, the only problem being they didn't tell the same time. If you tried to get a train in the 1870s, this problem would become immediately apparent to you. Say if a train was due to depart at 6:30, how would you know which clock to believe? As we saw earlier, in one Dublin train station alone, there was 2 clocks that told different times. Nor was this problem limited to Dublin. In 1873, in Ireland's third largest city, Cork, one local newspaper, the Cork Constitution, quipped that city clocks were so inaccurate that their only purpose was to lead people astray. This would even result in a court case when 2 men sued the Queenstown Railway Company in Cork after a train departed early, leaving them stranded for the night. They succeeded in getting the company to pay the hotel bill where they stayed. While this incident was minor, it did highlight the need for a reliable time system in the city and across Ireland. Eventually, the Royal Dublin Society, an organisation founded to nurture economic and cultural development, took it onto itself to investigate the matter and come up with a solution. In April 1873, it tasked its own Committee of Science to develop a system whereby time across Dublin at least would be standardised. Now, the ability to determine the correct time down to the second was not an issue. This was no longer done by sundials, but instead a far more complex and accurate measurement taken by astronomers was well established. Meanwhile, the technology to have all clocks reading the same time was also well established. Numerous industrialised cities in Britain had found a solution to this problem using a system of what were known as master and slave clocks. This would see the installation of a series of public clocks that were all controlled through electrical current by one single clock, the master clock. Therefore, once this master clock was accurate, the entire system worked perfectly. The only question was where this new master clock would be located and where the time it would use would be measured. Now, to many, the answer to this was clear. There was an observatory at Dunsink, 4 miles to the north of Dublin, and astronomers there could easily observe the correct time. They were willing to set up a master clock at the observatory, a device that would then control the slave clocks across the city. And there it seemed Dublin's problem with incorrect time was solved. Well, not quite though. The Royal Dublin Society, an organisation that considered itself the home of science and learning in the city, suggested in its report a very different plan. They wanted to locate the master clock in their headquarters at Leinster House in Dublin city centre, and rather than take time from the Dunsink Observatory that was to the north of Dublin, they recommended using readings from the Greenwich Observatory in London, which would communicate the time to Dublin each morning by telegram. Now naturally, the astronomers at Dunsink were nonplussed by this snub, and this resulted in a pretty ludicrous outcome. The most Irish of solutions to this problem. So in 1874, the Dunsink Observatory ignored the Royal Society and installed a system of clocks across the city. These were located at the Ballast Board, the headquarters of the port that overlooked O'Connell Bridge, the Bank of Ireland on College Green, and City Hall. These were all buildings which dominated one of the main thoroughfares through the city. At the same time, in that same year, the Royal Society of Dublin pressed ahead with their own scheme, and they established a system of 35 slave clocks across the city, set by the time telegraphed from the Greenwich Laboratory in London each morning. Now, the problem this created was far bigger than you might imagine. The Dunsink Observatory outside Dublin is hundreds of kilometres west of Greenwich. Therefore, the sun rises at Greenwich 25 minutes and 21 seconds earlier than it does in Dunsink, and this meant that the two clock systems in Dublin operated two different time zones. So, when a Dublin clock set by Greenwich time read 10 o'clock in the morning, for example, the rivals across the city set by Dunsink time would read 9:34 and 39 seconds. Unsurprisingly, this created untold problems in 19th century Dublin. For a visitor to the city, this must have caused immense confusion. In the space of a few metres, you could find two different time zones. Now in 1880, a government act settled the matter, stating that the official and correct time in Ireland was in fact the time set by the Dunsink Observatory outside Dublin. This, however, would only temporarily resolve the matter. In 1916, the British government passed a new Act of Parliament stating Ireland was now to run off Greenwich Mean Time, that's the observatory outside London. This now meant anything official, courts, trains, meetings, now used that Greenwich time. However, many ordinary people in Ireland refused to play ball with this. They continued to use Dunsink, or Irish time as it was known. Republicans and nationalists in particular saw it as a matter of principle. In their minds, Britain had no right to dictate the time in Ireland. The confusion this created persisted right through the revolutionary era. The Republican revolutionary Ernie O'Malley would later reflect on the difficulties of trying to organise political activities. People might turn up to a meeting 25 minutes early or late, for that matter. However, in 1922, after the conclusion of the War of Independence, the new government of the Free State decided to continue using Greenwich time. The reason behind this, partly at least, was because the island had been partitioned into the Free State and Northern Ireland, and they sought to avoid creating two different time zones on the island. Overall, however, by 1900, time, as we understand it, had been established. People may have disagreed on whether to use Dunsink or Greenwich time, but that was somewhat besides the point. They understood time in the same way that we do today, in 60-second minutes, 60-minute hours, and 24 hours a day. However, a huge swathe of the Irish population were still using a completely different system and understood time itself in a very different way. For me, this was the most surprising part of the research of this episode, that until the early 20th century, many Irish people had little need or use for clocks, and in some cases, didn't really understand them, or perhaps a better way of saying it is that they couldn't really relate to them. For the poor across rural Ireland, the advances in time measurement remained far removed from their daily lives, even into the early 20th century. For those who worked in agriculture, they performed what is referred to as task-based work that involved very limited coordination. They didn't have an 8-hour day. They simply had a series of jobs and tasks that had to be completed. In this situation, clocks were of limited value. Far more important was the rising and setting of the sun, and also weather if it was bad enough to impede work. So while clocks were considered by some as a symbol of prestige and wealth, for many poor people, they were far removed from their lives. They may even have had just negative connotations. Long considered a symbol of control, they were used extensively in workhouses, prisons, hospitals and schools to strictly regulate the day and to control people who entered those various institutions. Outside of such places, many Irish people used an entirely different method of time measurement. If we return to the Aran Islands, for example, in the 1890s, when the playwright John Millington Synge visited, he found a society with no clocks and little need for them. The islanders were living on farming and fishing. They rose at daybreak when they had breakfast and finished their work at sunset when they had dinner. The rest of the day was not rigidly structured around hours or time. They snacked when they were hungry, but didn't coordinate a midday meal. They obviously did need some way of gauging the passing of time throughout the day, but this was done by the observation of shadows cast inside the house. This could be very effective. People intimately understood the movement of shadows in their own homes intensely well. However, there was one major hitch with this system. When there was no sun shining or the weather was inclement and doors had to be closed, this basic clock no longer worked. Now, this could lead to major divergences in time. Synge, for example, was a man who came from a world of clocks, and he preferred his dinner each evening at 6 o'clock. Having his own watch, he knew what time it was, and on one occasion, when there was no shadow cast, he was served his dinner at 3 in the evening. This imprecise method of telling time was not just limited, though, to the remote Aran Islands. In the 1930s, the Folklore Commission gathered folk and personal memories from across the island. While clocks had become commonplace by this point, numerous accounts recalled different ways of telling time. For example, a Cork woman, Mrs. Cross, who was born in the 1860s, recalled her childhood and how her family told the time. When her parents went out to work in the fields, she was tasked with cooking dinner, which had to be ready for when her parents returned home. They had no clock, but instead her father would draw a line in the floor. As the sun moved across the sky, its shadow would creep along the floor, and when it reached the line her father had drawn, it was then time to start preparing dinner. Other accounts make reference to knowing what time of the day it was when shadows fell onto certain objects, like features in the landscape. In the Glen of Aherlow in South Tipperary, communities could tell the time by observing when the sun passed over a stone feature on the hillside. This feature was known as An Fear Bréaga, the false man, and it's unclear if it was specifically constructed to tell the time, or it was purely coincidental that the sun happened to pass over it at midday. Another example of this can be found outside Ballyvourney in County Cork, where a rock that fulfilled a similar function was known as the Hungry Rock. It was so called because the sun reached this feature at 2 o'clock, which was considered a late time to have dinner. Some who had a need for more specific time but didn't have watches used sundials. Now, these had been in existence for thousands of years and continued to be used right into the early 20th century. And the Folklore Commission records some pretty sophisticated homemade devices that were portable. One of these, for example, was found in a house in Castlefin in County Donegal. A sketch of it was later included in the folklore collections, and it shows hours on the clock and a series of coordinates that would help the user to set it up so it could read the sun properly. You'll find a link to this on the WhatsApp and Telegram channels. You'll find those in the show notes below. And finally, it's worth also bearing in mind that these communities who didn't use clocks were, contrary to many outsiders' claims, able to gauge the passage of time at night as well. This wasn't so much of an issue in summer when the sun has scarcely set on the western horizon before it begins to break the darkness in the east. However, in winter, when darkness could be up to 17 hours a day, it was possible to lose track of time. However, the Folklore Commission recorded how people used the constellation of stars known in Ireland as An Treadaíonn. In English, this is called the Pleiades or Seven Sisters and is visible between 6:30 p.m. and 1:17 a.m. in winter in Ireland. Observing this allowed people to gauge time through the first half of the night anyway. Understandings of time have obviously changed over the course of the 20th century. Nearly all sectors of the economy have become industrialised, and this requires high levels of coordination, which demands exact time. Artificial lighting also allows us to work after dark, if required, so sunrise and sunset are no longer as important as they once were. However, these levels of industrialisation means we now need to know precisely what time it is. The development of the atomic clock in the later 20th century, which is correct down to a particle of a second, and then the internet, which allows us to synchronise time across the globe if needs be, has revolutionised the way we live our lives. Time no longer varies. What is the correct time is no longer a matter of guesswork or debate. This is something we accept today as a given. We even think it's natural, but as we've seen in this episode, it's a very recent development, something some of our great-grandparents would certainly have struggled to comprehend. Now that's where I'm going to leave today's show. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did researching it. And don't forget, you can get the third part of my series on the Troubles, which looks at the Battle of the Bogside and the IRA split of 1969. That's coming this Thursday for supporters of the show on Patreon. If you want to become a supporter and get that episode, check out the links in the show notes below. Until next time, Sloan.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.